Hey, let's get right to Max Armstrong. You know him, you love him. And Max, it's so great to have you on the program today again. We check in once a month to see what's happening out on the farms. How you doing, Max?
Hey, John, nice to join you. Appreciate the opportunity as always.
Oh, it's great. Okay, we've got some rain this weekend, at least in some parts of Illinois. How are the farmers feeling generally about the crop right now at the end of July?
Well, I tell you, it depends on where you are, of course, but right in the heart of the Corn Belt here, I have some Illinois farmer friends who would look around both directions and then have me swear to not tell a grain trader that right now, some of the folks are looking at the best corn crops they will ever grow.
Really?
And, but you got to remember, that's not the case everywhere. And if you go out of the Western Corn Belt, Nebraska, for example, very dry there. Now, they irrigate, of course, some of that land, quite a bit of it in that part of the world, but Kansas has been quite dry. There are some other pockets too, and there have been people wanting to make comparisons between 2022 and 2012, which was a famous drought year, and I would simply say there really is no comparison. I mean, if you look at the amount of the Corn Belt area that was in drought 10 years ago this summer, it was far more extensive all across the Corn Belt with no holes in that area of drought. This year, you have some rather expansive areas of Illinois, Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Wisconsin that have little or no drought. Iowa, actually, the biggest corn-producing state of the country, has not much drought. There's some in the west and the northwest part of that state. So, and that's a long answer to your question. Generally speaking, we're in pretty good shape right now with 61% of the corn crop good to excellent. Now, it is sliding some. That's down 3 percentage points in the past week. And about 60% of the soybeans, 59% good to excellent. That's down 2 percentage points in the past week. We generally expect crop conditions to slide a little bit, especially on corn, in the month of August. This is just a little bit premature that the condition is slipping. And remember, we're still in the midst of pollination on a lot of this corn crop.
Right, for sure. Oh, that's a great worded answer. I appreciate the diligence you give us in the detail. People want to know. And we got to take a break for weather and traffic, Max, but afterwards I want to talk.
John, that was your way of saying that was too long an answer. I know. I'll shorten them up.
No, that went right to where it needed to go. After we take a little break, I do want to talk about climate change and the efforts that farmer and agriculture as a whole is making on this. And we'll have our wrap our hands around that. But first, let's get a look at weather and traffic. Mary Vandeveld, Your Money Matters. We got Max Armstrong, the legend, here on the line with us. And Max, you're going to have to forgive a dumb question, because I think what I do here is, I am not a country boy. I raised in the suburbs and in the city, and I've got some dumb ones for you. So here's one I want to always, I've always been curious about. I know that we have farm subsidies and crop insurance that helps farmers out, that the government plays a part in. Number one, does that lower food prices? And then the follow-up would be, could we just give more subsidies to help the prices in the grocery stores for some of the produce? I'm sure I'm simplifying a very complex question.
And you're exactly right, John, with your final response there. There are so many shades of gray when it comes to agriculture policy. And anybody who tells you that it has to be this way or that way, you need to question them about it. In reality, our subsidization of agriculture, whatever form it takes, has guaranteed dramatically lower food prices. We have among the lowest food prices of any developed nation in the world, and we lose sight of that sometimes. And it really, you know, it continues to be, in most years, very little of the overall spending of a family, what we're spending at the supermarket. And we're seeing this bump up in prices now, mainly because of the bump up in energy. So if energy continues to slip back, as, you know, this recession continues to settle in, as many people feel it is around the globe, then we could start to see some easing of food prices. You mentioned Cheerios a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
You know, you need to remember that very, very little of the cost of that box of Cheerios goes into the raw commodity itself. Very little. Just a few cents account for the price of the Cheerios, the actual Cheerios in the box. The rest of it, of course, is transportation, the processing, the marketing, the lights that are turned on at the supermarket. So all of those inflationary factors, after those oats left the farm, which may have been, by the way, oats in in Norway or Finland. We don't grow many in the United States, and there isn't much grown anymore actually up in Canada. So a lot of the oats are imported into the U.S. But, it's inflation off the farm that has really been accounting for most of the inflation in food prices.
So I guess that answers my question, is if you subsidize the farmers more, that ain't going to really make a dent, because the overall price of the food itself for many products is not the actual price of the ingredients that come from the farm.
Well, you have to ask yourself the question, though, what if we lost more of our farmers? What if we became more reliant upon imports from other countries? Then you have a whole other scenario. If you're relying on grain to come in from Argentina and Brazil to feed our livestock, or wheat to come in from Canada or some other country to make our bread, then you've got a whole other problem. If you've lost so many farmers that you become dependent upon imports, then you're very, very exposed to whatever prices they want to charge in other countries.
True. Hey, we got a great question from the 847 that I'm sure you understand, but I don't. Please ask Max if the corn seed has been crossed with the soy seed. Born allergic to soy and 30 years ago, developed an allergy to corn. Interesting.
I'm not aware of what they're talking about, to be honest with you.
That's okay.
A lot of people have allergies, and I understand that. And certainly peanut allergies have been the most prominent, actually, in agriculture. And then, of course, some are allergic to the gluten in wheat. That certainly has been a prominent one, and the industry is trying to address that. But I'm not familiar with the particular one that this person is talking about.
Yeah, I don't know if they're talking about cross-contamination between where the seeds are stored or how they're done, that someone could have a cross-across allergy. But, hey, I know it's a confusing area, and a lot of people always just want answers. It can be frustrating.
Yeah, so, and farmers do, in some instances, have to maintain the identity preserve. In other words, they have to segregate, depending on what the grain is. Let's say a farmer is producing non-genetically enhanced corn, then he or she must keep that in a separate bin, make sure that there is no cross-contamination by all means. So, farmers are concerned about that when there is the need to be concerned about it.
For sure. Okay, let's open the conversation about sustainable agriculture. We have this conversation a lot when it comes to vehicles on this show, and I think that's where a lot of people's mind goes, of that's the fight of climate change, our transportation. But agriculture plays a huge role in the changing climate, but I imagine it's a tug and pull just like it is in the transportation world. What's your overall take on how agriculture is handling any transition that could be coming to be a little greener?
Farmers are sitting on a massive carbon sink, John. I mean, look at all of these fields. When you travel down Interstate 55 or Interstate 65, that's a carbon sink out there. And the carbon is being channeled into that ground. And farmers are saying, okay, how do we get compensated for this?
Right.
And, seriously, and rightly so, because everybody is thinking, all right, what do we do with all this carbon? Where do we put it? Well, farmers stand ready to do more of this. They're putting cover crops out on the land, so when there isn't corn or soybean crop being grown out there, they have what appears to be weeds. But I would hasten to point out that these crops are cover crops, helping keep the topsoil in place and helping keep some of that carbon right there in our soil. So farmers are saying, all right, how can we get compensated for this? And there are companies that are coming forward saying, we want to sign you up. We think we can get you, we can get the carbon credits, we can compensate you on the farm. In reality, to this point, the compensation has been very insignificant, and not many farmers that I know personally have signed up into these deals. They're still waiting to see. They say, show me the money, John.
Right. Well, so what you're suggesting is that they get paid to do the cover crop, or they get paid to do these very green-friendly things.
Absolutely. And they've been doing it for years, been keeping the topsoil in place. You're too young to remember that back in the 70s, when you would drive down Interstate 55 to Springfield or take I-57 to Champaign, the topsoil was blowing off of the fields. It was blowing across the highway. It was the ditches were brown. There was a spring. There was a march in Chicago. I remember being up on the north side, 15 blocks west of Wrigley Field at the old WGN studios, where the television station is now. You couldn't see two blocks away. The sky was yellow because topsoil was blowing into the city. That rarely, rarely happens anymore, because we have farmers taking care of the ground, keeping crops out there to keep the topsoil in place.
So you would, we only got about 30 seconds, so we got to take another break, Max. But I guess the idea is that you would contend that most farmers are partners in this fight against climate change and eager and ready to help.
Absolutely. Absolutely. They say, put me in the game, coach. I mean, they're ready to go. But obviously, they would love to be compensated for what they're doing out there already and then for what they stand ready to do in the future to sequester more carbon than they are now.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break. Then we got the news. More with Max Armstrong. By the way, 312-981-7200 if you have any questions. I read a blog from a Daily Farmer, and I was kind of blown away at how much bureaucracy there was to being a farmer. I want to ask Max about that. I can already hear him chuckling at the question before it even comes, but we'll get to that after the break. Then the news here on WGN. We still got a few more minutes with Max Armstrong, the man, the myth, the legend here on WGN, all things ag business. Hey, Max, we got a really interesting question from the 312, and there's no doubt that agriculture has played a huge part in what's happened in the Ukraine, whether it's Russia blocking access to the Black Sea, where Ukraine is able to export a lot of their wheat. 312 wanted to know, and I don't know how much you've dove into this, can the U.S. send agriculture products to Africa to stunt Putin's weaponizing the crops from Ukrainian fields? He needs to be stopped by any means possible. Whether it's this one or other wars, agriculture plays a part in him.
It really does. The quick answer to that question, though, is we don't have enough to send there right now. You know, we have supplies that are down around the world for one reason or another. And then, of course, he is bombed over there. You know, they reportedly had some kind of an agreement last week to allow for passage. You know, anybody that believes Putin, anybody believes a Russian leader after all of these years, how naive can you possibly be? Right. I guess is my point. And he proved it. First thing Saturday morning, we get the news that he's bombed the port facility over there. Well, it turns out either they were a bad shot or maybe they were aiming for something else. They didn't hit any of the grain silos. But what insurance company in the world is going to protect a vessel moving on the high seas that is going to try to get into the Black Sea ports and haul grain out of there? I'm telling you, the devil is in the details when it comes to trying to ship grain out of Ukraine. I mean, first you've got to get it to the ports, and then you got to get it past the mines, and then you got to get it past the missiles that this guy is dropping on them.
Right. So the short answer to that is we also just don't have enough supply to send out. But I appreciate people still caring.
No. Let me come back to that, John. We donate more to feed people around the world than any other nation in the world. And we have a tremendous track record. It goes back to the Food for Peace program back in the late 60s. And the United States feeds the world through charity. I mean, it is a remarkable track record. And this often gets overlooked, that we are the most generous nation in the world. There's a program called PL480, whereby we donate. We donate millions of tons of grain to other countries to help feed them. And the African continent is one of those places. We just can't keep up with the starvation.
All right. Oh, that's a sentence that you clip and you say, boy, that makes your heart sink a little bit. But I'm glad we are stepping up where we can. I wanted to ask about this blog. I was reading on thebusinessjournal.com, and it was a farmer. I think he's out in California, and he wrote out a daily kind of what he does on the day, and he, arrives super early, has a meeting with his staff. But he talks about servicing the tractor and safety checks. He checks reports from the state capitol and from the nation's capital. He fills out forms and memos, finally gets in the field. About an hour later, he has to come back, do a quarterly training session, go back out to the field. And what he ended up saying was, look, there's a lot of bureaucracy in farming that people don't necessarily know about, and that some of our farmers are not spending enough time in the field. Your thoughts on that?
I had a chicken farmer tell me a few years ago, he said he had to hire a full-time employee to keep track of all of the regulatory filings that are necessary. And this was not one of the big poultry producers. This was a small independent operator. But he said, yeah, I've got a full-time employee who not only handles the federal regulations, and you mentioned, work regulations such as those of OSHA. Let me go down the list. You've got EPA, FDA, USDA, the Forest Service, which, of course, is a part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Then you have the Interior Department, which regulates all of that federally owned land in the West where cattle are grazed. The Fish and Wildlife Service. Oh, the Army Corps of Engineers, because of the river system, the dams that allow the barges that carry our grain down there or bring fertilizer or fuel up the river. So all of those agencies touch agriculture in some way. There have been times that the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, I have maintained, has more power over farmers than the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture.
Wow. I get the need for regulation, and I'm not trying to,
Absolutely.
Modern economics are based on increasing efficiency, so this has got to be a battle moving forward as farmers try and increase their efficiency. They can't do it if they're sitting in there in the house the whole time.
Yeah, and you have to realize, John, we don't operate in a vacuum. We compete with farmers in Brazil and Argentina who do not have anywhere near the regulations that we have, and so, you know, with our farmers somewhat hamstrung when it comes to competing in the global marketplace. So that really is a challenge with all of the regulations that are coming down. But to come back to your point there briefly, I would maintain that our food safety regulations especially have served us exceedingly well in the United States. You know, I tell farmers, be careful complaining about regulation on everything, because when it comes to food safety and having a product that is still reasonably inexpensive, our regulations have served us very well, especially when you compare to other nations.
Right. Hey, we got one last question, about a minute for the answer. Can you ask Max if any other farmers are growing rye corn? Can you first explain what that is and then answer the question?
Oh, that's a variety of sweet corn. Yeah, you'll find it grown in the Chicago area. And just, you know, when you go to the farmers markets, ask them about if they have rye or if they know someone who has it. It's a particular variety, and some people like it. The Illini Super Sweet is one that people really like, too. The sweet corn, that's what they're talking about. That's the kind you eat right off the cob.
I don't think they do it anymore, but in Urbana, I used to always go to the Sweet Corn Festival when I lived down there. It was always a highlight of August. Hopefully they can get it back. I know they had to stop it because of the pandemic. Max Armstrong, as always, I wish we had more time. I appreciate our monthly check-ins, because the show's called Your Money Matters, and our money has a lot to do with what happens on the farms, and I appreciate your time.
Hey, John, I appreciate it, too. Don't believe Bertrand when he calls me a rascal.
No, I don't know if he was calling me a rascal or you, but either way, he's probably right on both counts.
All
right, Max, take care. Always good to chat with you.